contagion kit is something new. Can you tell us about that and what's in it and what it's for?
Well, the contagion kit is specifically geared towards a respiratory virus. It mm-hmm. includes some of the medications that we've been talking about that are well known to be able to treat respiratory viruses. And mm-hmm. importantly, it includes a nebulizer, a mm-hmm. way to aerosolize a liquid medication so that you can breathe it into the lungs. Mm-hmm. Again, these kits are not meant to replace your doctor or a relationship with a doctor. They are not meant for you to fly solo. We have telemedicine visits mm-hmm. available if you have any questions about the symptoms you're having. There is a booklet in there as well that supports and kind of coaches you through what symptoms you may be having from something. So these aren't meant to be a panacea to replace mm-hmm. everything in medicine. It's a way, however, for people to feel and to be prepared, to be at the ready, to be more resilient, and to be more immune from the sorts of intrusions that we saw during COVID, where your insurance company or your own doctor or the pharmacist or the pharmacy was refusing to let people get a hold of medication.
Hi, everybody. I'm Christine Dolan, and this is the Globalist in Plain Sight Sunday show. And I am honored today to have three of our contributors with us. Jeff Cleghorn, who has been out in front testifying in Georgia and Connecticut to protect children from the trans aggression that's going on there. And Jim Kunstler, who I refer to as the Mark Twain of the 21st century. He's up in New York. Jim's in New York. Jeff's down in Georgia. And Dr. Chris Cassell, who is in Florida and Delaware. Guys, welcome to the show.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
So we're going to talk about the debate coming up on Tuesday night. And I have real issues with this, having worked at the networks, because I think that part of what's been going on this year for the few debates that we have had is that we're not asking some of the bigger questions. But first, I want to start off with you, Dr. Chris. Let's talk about the Biden book that just came out in the last several days. And this is about the Bidens. It's written by Jill Biden's ex-husband, Bill Stevenson. And you helped to get this book out there. What's the lead of the book that you can tell us in terms of the narratives that have been put out there in the past? Because this goes back to the early days of the Bidens and when Jill and Joe allegedly met.
Yeah. Thank you for having me, Christine. The gist of the book, the heart and soul of the book, was that Bill Stevenson was the first donor, if you will, to Joe Biden's political career. And then, of course, Joe took his wife, stole his wife, an affair and all that. And then he subsequently embarked on a number of years of lawfare and warfare against Bill Stevenson. And so Bill, out of, sort of love and respect for his first wife, really held back for any number of years. But when he saw what Joe was doing to Donald Trump, to President Trump, then he said, I've got to publish this book. I should have published it in 2020, but I didn't want to interfere with the election. But now he sees the lawfare. He's saying he's doing to Trump exactly what he did to me. This is a big part of what Bill describes in the book as his motivation to actually finishing the book. Notwithstanding my prodding to tell him to, get his term paper done and turn it in. I've sort of been nudging him since, I guess, last fall when I first started. But But here's he did it last Tuesday. Send me a copy of the book. There is the. Oh, let me see if I can light it up there better.
Well, it's called The Biden Brothers and Jill, The Early Years, My 55 Years with the Biden Family.
Yeah, that's the cover of the book. It's published out of Monroe Printing in New Jersey, and it's caught the attention of the Trump campaign. They're probably going to be selling the book for Bill at all of the next rallies. It's interesting. Bill has no literary or educational background in writing, and it's pretty obvious in the book that it's sort of a stream of consciousness kind of writing with a lot of pieces added to and added to and added to and added to, front end, back end of the book. But the gist of it goes to the early years when he comes into contact with the Bidens, when his wife has an affair with Joe, and ultimately that ruins his marriage. And then the warfare starts, and it's 40 years, literally 40 years of bringing down the Department of Justice, the FBI, the IRS on Bill's head. And it's story after story after story, even to the extent that in the very front end of the book, Joe Biden actually appropriates a story from Bill about Bill's mother and their football coach. And within about 20 minutes of that, appropriates the story that Bill has just told him and tells another person the same story as if it happened to Joe. And it gives you an insight into the real Joe Biden. And then a few pages later, there's a discussion of how they come to Bill at the 11th hour, right before the election, when he's about to lose his first senatorial election to Caleb Boggs in Delaware, and they come to Bill to get $3,000 to pay off the union, the Teamsters, to blockade the entrance to the News Journal, the local newspaper, to prevent the edition coming out on election morning, where in the News Journal was throwing their support behind the incumbent, Caleb Boggs. And they literally hired Frank Sheeran to distribute money. I mean, you know Frank Sheeran from the stories of I Paint Houses. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're all familiar with that, but it's really heavy duty mob stuff. And this is 1972, the first time that Joe becomes really endeared to the mob, or one way or another owes them. But Frank Sheeran actually blockades the newspaper from being delivered on election morning to keep the op-ed page from supporting Joe's opponent. There's some really interesting insights. And Delaware is a small state. Everybody kind of knows everybody. Mm-hmm. I lived within for about half of my 40 years at my house on Buck Road in Delaware. Joe lived about half a mile in one direction, and then he moved about a mile and a quarter in the other direction. So I've been his neighbor a very, very long time, known him a long time, known the family a long time, and I don't have much good to say about them. So one way or another, a lot of the book is old news to me. It is told with a singularly personal, very Holmesy sort of touch. I mean, Bill is a likable guy. He was the founder and the owner of one of the best rock and roll bars that ever existed, something called the Stone Balloon. He really was in many ways a big reason for the launch of Bruce Springsteen under the mainstream, and Springsteen's use of the Stone Balloon brought the Stone Balloon to prominence in the world of rock and roll. So Bill is a really engaging sort of scatterbrained, hail fellow, well-met guy who's fundamentally a decent guy, fundamentally a nice guy, but he's been in it up to his into his eyeballs with the Biden clan over the years, and he sure does know where all the bodies are buried. I read the whole front of the book, the whole back of the book. And I last night fell asleep about midway through the most vicious divorce proceeding in the state of Delaware history. And we've had some doozies. So that's about how far I am through it.
All right. So, but the, you know, what's interesting is I covered Joe Biden in 1988 and he dropped out of that race because of plagiarism. So the plagiarism in 1988 was foreseen in 1972. Having said that, right now we're in the campaign between Harris and Trump. That's Tuesday night's maybe the only debate there, but we can't really drop off sort of the Biden story because it still is in play. Jim, let me turn to you because we talked about this last night. I mean, we have the Alford plea that Hunter decided to file. The judge didn't accept that. And so now he pled guilty to 9 counts. I think it was 3 felonies and 6 misdemeanors or vice versa in the tax trial in California. He's going to be sentenced on December 16th in Los Angeles. And what the question that I keep on saying to myself is, what happens to this 2024 election if President Biden decides that he is going to pardon his son? Because I find it a little bit unbelievable that he is at the stage he is at health-wise, at the end of his presidency, and this is his only son, and he's going to allow Hunter to go to jail.
Well, I don't think he has to pardon him until after the sentencing, and that'll be after Election Day. So, the only question might be, there's a lot of chatter right now about the election fraud extending the period of not knowing who was elected until Christmas. Mm-hmm. That was speculation on the web this morning. I don't remember where exactly because I read 1,000 things, but that would mean that Joe Biden would have to put off any kind of pardoning until that was resolved, and who knows? He's not in great condition. Maybe he will feel a necessity to pardon Hunter before that, and I don't know. The whole thing is pretty damn murky.
Well, it is. It's like no other cycle that I've ever covered in my life. Jeff, let me bring you in on this. From your perspective in Georgia, which is, a hotbed of all kinds of politics down there, including election fraud, and we've got the lawsuit and everything. What's your perspective in terms of a southern state that was in the eye of the storm in 2020? Going into this debate on Tuesday?
Well, sounds and looks like it's a jump ball at this point. From what I can tell, Trump is trending slightly higher consistently in the polls, but it's tight with Georgia having a large African-American population, many of whom unfortunately vote Democrat only. That has rekindled some interest on some folks' part in the race because Biden wasn't inspiring to them for obvious reasons. And so, she has the Stacey Abrams. we're all a bunch of buck-tooth, backwoods, hillbilly rednecks, racists. She has that infrastructure in place. Harris does now to make it a run.
What was it like when Harris was in the state of Georgia a couple of weeks ago?
Well, let me tell you what it was like for me. Okay. I've never voted for Trump. In 2020, I voted for Biden. I had prior to that a pretty intense case of Trump derangement syndrome, which I have managed to cure myself of in the subsequent years with the help of a lot of different factors, including you, Christine.
I don't know if that's good or bad.
Although I admit I am not yet to a point of being comfortable voting for the guy. I told you before, I think he's a congenital jackass. I'm a sixth generation Georgian, born and raised on a dirt road in a rural area evangelical Christian family, working class family, red, white, and blue America. I took junior ROTC in high school and went to a military school and served in the Army. Having voted for Biden in 2020, I now regret it. He has governed in a way that is very different than what he represented during the campaign from the basement of his Delaware home. He hasn't been a healer or a uniter. He's done the opposite. You know, they came to Georgia with Stacey Abrams' help and sabotaged the All-Star game for Major League Baseball, accusing us again of being a bunch of backward-ass country Fs, and harmed plenty of small Black-owned businesses who lost economic opportunities because of that sabotage and the willful misrepresentations made by the Democrats and by Biden and by Stacey Abrams. You know, that Black people have difficulty registering to vote in Georgia, which is not true, or voting in Georgia, which is emphatically not true, as evidenced by the historic high voter turnout and registration in recent election cycles. Notwithstanding, what finally clicked on me was the Biden administration, with Harris being right there front and center, pushing this transgender ideology on children. And you're talking to me today because we met through my experience going back several decades as a gay rights activist at the national and state and local level, beginning in the early 1990s. And I would go on Fox News and talk to the Bill O'Reilly Factor, or go and talk to Pat Buchanan when he had his MSNBC show, and we would go at it. But it was my trying to advocate on behalf of people like me that were just ordinary Americans who were wired a little different for whatever reason, and that we love our families, we love our country, and we want to be good citizens, and we want the dignity that we're entitled to as Americans. So that was the conversation we had. And that, by and large, turned out pretty well from my perspective. But then in recent years, in the aftermath of that, and turbocharged because of the Biden-Harris administration, they have been pushing this transgender stuff on children, investing significant amounts of government pressure, legal pressure to push this stuff in classrooms. They are taking custody of children away from parents. There was a recent incident in Maryland, the state of Maryland, where a parents lost custody of their child because the school was transitioning, so-called transitioning, trying to turn this child into the opposite sex, which is a delusion and an impossibility. You know, when I was talking to Bill O'Reilly or Pat Buchanan and arguing about gay rights, I wasn't calling them names. I wasn't telling lies. I was using facts and evidence and personal anecdotes. I was trying to persuade them, or at least maybe change some of their listeners' hearts and minds. That's not what happens with this transgender stuff that they're pushing on kids. If you speak out like I'm doing now, then you become the target of vile. The Southern Poverty Leadership Center, SPLC, calls me a far-right activist because I have joined a group called Gays Against Groomers, which has a Georgia chapter, and I'm proud to be a member of Gays Against Groomers in Georgia, because we're standing up against the sexualization, indoctrination, and medicalization of children, which is unethical. And it's the Biden and Harris and Tim Walz all favor and support this stuff, and they have all pushed it in different ways and at different times. And so I'm done with that.
Jeff, thank you for your service to the country, and God bless you for speaking up, because I know you feel very strongly of protecting children, as I do too, in terms of the human trafficking arena. Dr. Chris, let me go back to you. Tuesday night. All right. We have, we're going to have David Muir, who I think is a good journalist. I don't know the other woman who's going to be the ABC reporter. But the one thing that I think that we're missing from this debate, okay, is the focus on issues. And when we talk about what Jeff was just saying, the Biden-Harris administration, it's hard to separate Harris out of what the Biden administration has been doing for the last 4 years. What are your thoughts about what happened in the medical field in terms of the vaccinations?
Oh, gosh. You still occasionally run into doctors who double down and say, oh, the vaccines are great. Everything's good. The whole world was going to die. We did the best we could, yada, yada, yada. But anybody with any ounce of scientific method, skepticism, or ability to read a database, understands that there are real problems with the money flow, real problems with Big Pharma, real problems with the FDA, the World Health Organization, the CDC, NIH. They really participated, whether by ignorance or willful ignorance, in what effectively was a genocide. And it was really, really bad in the United States. And anybody who looks at the data knows very clearly the data says that the vaccine is not a vaccine. It is an immune-altering shot, very much unlike the traditional definition of a vaccine. It does not prevent disease. It does not prevent the transmission of disease. It induces a state of disease by causing the proliferation of spike proteins. The net effect of those spike proteins is to turbocharge a lot of diseases, notably diseases of the reproductive system and the heart. These are the most obvious and most early ones. It also turbocharges cancer, and I believe it turbocharges Alzheimer's. It wipes out old people. It is effectively the culling of the herd in the wiping out of old people. Oddly, our reaction to it, the shutdown, the lockdown, ended up irrevocably damaging a whole generation of children who do not get this disease. They don't die of it, and they don't spread it to anybody. And now we're coming to see irrefutable data that the more vaccine boosters you take, the more often you will get COVID, and the sicker you will be, and the worse your hospitalization will be. And these are directly linked. We're way beyond the idea of coincidence, and we're far into causality. These things are causally, statistically irrefutable now. So you still see the occasional doctor who's desperate to say, I only did what I was told. I'm a pleaser. I want to please my bosses. I want to please the hospital. I want to please United Healthcare. I want to please the government. I want to please NIH. And doctors are fundamentally pleasers. But most intelligent, caring doctors realize we screwed up. As a medical professional, you know, I came to the light very early on. My first article in April of 2020 was, you're not going to create a vaccine against a cold virus. You've never done it, and you won't be able to do it in the future because the virus is too slippery. It changes too quickly. You can't make a vaccine to it. And then they went in the fall of that year and changed the definition of vaccine so they could include it in the emergency use authorization. It's a catastrophe. The politicization of the whole COVID thing, which was, I believe, in large measure a hoax from the get-go, the politicization was awful. I mean, that's my one complaint with Donald Trump was that he believed in the system. He believed in Dr. Birx. He believed in, to a lesser extent, at least initially, in Fauci. He smelled a rat pretty early on, but he actually bought into the system and actually gave them what they really needed, was immunity from malpractice litigation. And as such, President Trump was complicit in the early stages of the perpetuation of the hoax. I think he's a very quick learner, and I don't think he'll make that mistake again.
Well, I think because, you know, Bobby Kennedy's joined forces with him, I think it would be hard pressed to believe that Bobby would be joining forces with Trump now.
Bobby is coming out of this thing pretty much smelling like a rose, isn't he? I mean, I've been a friend. I've known Bobby since we were both about 10 years old. We're exactly the same vintage, where our paths crossed over and over and over again during life. And I tell you, he is really coming up smelling like a rose. In fact, he's probably got the best odor of any Kennedy I know.
Well, you know what, guys? Let's go to a commercial break. And coming out of that, Jim, I'm going to go to you. And I want you to, if you were sitting there at the table, what questions would the three of you ask? And I'll start with you, Jim, after we come back from the commercial break.
I'm David Cross, and you may know me from my election integrity work, but I also own U.S. Asset Management, a family-owned and operated investment advisory practice. I'm a certified portfolio manager, and my job is to help you make better decisions with your money. One of the things we try to avoid is investing in companies that push the woke agenda. If you're invested with one of the big firms out there, there's a pretty good chance that you're feeding the beast that hates your values. Our company is 100% conservative, and we'd love to have an opportunity to work with you. Check us out at us-am.com and look for our big, proud American Eagle logo.
If you haven't noticed, gold has reached a new high, all-time highs, actually, and keeps going up every day. Why is that? It's because precious metals are a long-time historical store of value. And if you own a portfolio and you have assets in the fiat currencies, i.e. stocks, bonds, cash, or whatever, you're vulnerable to hyperinflation, which is coming as our debt explodes another trillion every 90 days. It's really scary. So how do you protect yourself? Go to Advisor Metals. If you look on any of our CDM.press sites, about halfway down, there's an ad for Advisor Metals. Click on it, fill out the form for your contact info, and Igor Bashatsky will contact you and talk to you. It's an easy conversation. There's no sales pitch. He's completely verified by us. He has a regulatory background we've checked into. We've checked with his bankers. We've checked with his IRA custodians for metals. And we can highly recommend Advisor Metals and ERA. So go to Advisor Metals. If you call them directly, tell them we sent you at CDM, and he'll definitely take care of you. But protect your portfolio, because you really need to. It's coming. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm back with three of my favorite gentlemen today. So, Jim, let's turn to you. With the debate on Tuesday night, what are the questions and the issues you want to see covered?
The first question I would have is I would ask Kamala Harris to explain how exactly she got nominated. By what process did she end up being the candidate for president? Because there didn't seem to be any input at all from the rank and file of the Democratic Party. Maybe she could illuminate how that happened.
Okay.
And then I'd certainly like to hear her version of it.
Her version of it. Okay. So Tim Walz was head of the Rules Committee for the convention. So I thought that was kind of interesting that he was chosen at the end, because this is not somebody at this point in time I think would be a good choice. But again, you know, that is who's on her ticket. What about issues? What are the issues?
Well, she's just got a lot to answer for, and the Biden administration has a lot to answer for. I think the overwhelming majority of Americans are not in favor of letting every discontented person in the globe across the border and not have them vetted. And I think that by the same token, most Americans are not in favor of censorship, and especially a government-sponsored, government-organized crusade against free speech. And I think, for me, those are the two most important issues. The other one, which has sort of fallen off the radar screen of most citizens, is the war in Ukraine. And my personal belief at the moment, or interpretation or analysis, is that the Russians are rolling up what's left of Ukraine and are going to conclude their operation sooner rather than later. And that if they manage to get to the Dnieper River before November, which I think they're trying to do, I think that'll be the end of it. The Ukrainians will have to come to terms at the table. There will have to be negotiations, and they don't have any leverage, and neither does NATO or the United States. You know, it's very significant that this past week, a building in Ukraine that held a large contingent of NATO advisors was hit by an Iskander missile, and 709 people reportedly died. Some of them Americans. They were medevaced out to Poland and Germany, and the wounded who didn't make it, you know, they announced that they had died in Poland when in fact they had been, you know, hit by this missile in Ukraine. As a result of that, another rumor going around is that the entire management team of the Saab company's early warning system operation in that building was lost, killed. And, you know, a couple of days later, the foreign minister of Sweden resigned without a whole lot of explanation. I think it was because they lost all those people in that attack. So that operation's rolling up, and it's going to be an enormous embarrassment to the Harris-Biden administration. So this is a very unpopular regime that is really only held together by woke hysteria, which is really kind of, you know, mass formation psychosis hysteria under another name.
So we're all of the generation where there were three, after Labor Day, there were three debates for the presidency and one for the vice presidency. And the debates were broken down under the Presidential Debate Commission that was started in 1987. That has been pushed over to the side now, and now it's all falling down to the networks. But we used to have foreign affairs was separated from domestic affairs, and then there was one presidential debate where you could ask anything. Do you think that that's a disadvantage? I mean, because it's interesting to me because every one of you is talking about one thread with different topics, and that's coercion and force and fallacies and lies and deception. And I can't remember, seriously, covering politics for 40 plus years, that we've ever been at this pivotal point in time when we're talking about reality versus unreality. So Jeff, let me go to you. What would you ask if you were sitting in David Muir's seat?
Well, I would be curious about Ms. Harris's position on the issue of transgender in youth and transgender in children, and in particular, inside government schools and universities where power is and money is being used to teach the ideology of queer ideology, that sex and sexuality and gender can mean anything anybody says they mean, and whatever they say they mean is their so-called lived experience, and the rest of us have to kowtow to changing our words and changing our definitions of longstanding words and using new invented imaginary words to describe these people based on their lived experience, like cisgender or I almost wanted to say bipolar, which might be the most appropriate. But what do they call it? Like you can be more than one gender or be more than one sex.
What is it? Intersex means you're
non-binary. Non-binary.
Non-binary.
It's just utterly so ridiculous. But this is hitting kids hard, and it's hitting them in increasing instances inside classrooms. We have a large number of specific examples in Atlanta area schools of this ideology being put forward in various different ways. That includes these drag queen story hours where out of the blue drag queens, which are about sex and sexuality by definition, for those of us adults who have been to drag shows and enjoyed them, they're adults only for a reason. Now, all of a sudden, some of these drag queens want to proselytize queer theory to children. Why? Why aren't they going to nursing homes or assisted living centers and reading books to the elderly and the frail? Why do they only go after children with rainbows and unicorns and drag queens and glitter to this fake imaginary pronouns and identities? And kids are getting sucked up into it, including here in Georgia, including outside of Atlanta and in some of the rural areas. A lot of it is online harm that is happening. But in any case, my question for Harris would be, Why do you think, as California and San Francisco governments believe, that the government and school teachers and counselors have a better position to treat their child's mental disorder if a child communicates some confusion about their sex? Why do you think that children should be taught to keep secrets from their parents? Why do you think that school teachers should keep secrets from children's parents? And why do you think that parents should lose custody of their kids if they refuse to allow their children to proceed down this harmful and dangerous path of experimental, non-FDA approved chemical castration drugs to treat a mental illness, a mental disorder of gender dysphoria in kids, or whatever the diagnosis is? You know, why do you think that that's okay for the government to come into our lives? Why and when? I mean, this has all come up over the last 10 years. There was no such thing as a transgender kid when any of us were in school, of course, because they hadn't invented the fiction yet. It's a big mess. And I would like to see them ask her a question that would pin her down on some of this stuff.
Go ahead, Jim.
I just want to make one point that I think has been really badly overlooked by the American public, and certainly by the news media, which is deliberately not paying attention. These drag queens in the story hours are not presenting themselves as women. They're presenting themselves as monsters, and women as monsters. And that's a very deleterious kind of idea to put across.
So go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, I worked with Milton Edgerton in the very beginning in the first transgender surgeries at the very, very beginning in the 1970s. Jeff is absolutely right about the underlying psychiatric disease. But if you, the great attack here is against the language. I mean, for instance, the transgender movement is primarily homophobic. And as a physician, I reject homophobia. I mean, I reject it on the fundamental basis that it teaches a person to hate themselves. But transgender really promotes homophobia. It also promotes pedophilia, which of course is one of the great taboos. I mean, this effort was made with the NAMBLA movement, the North American Man Boy Love Association, many years ago. And the gay community rightfully rejected the NAMBLA movement and said, no, these people are not part of our collection of people under the tent. These are misfits. These are people, we don't want to go near this taboo. And my hat is off to the gay community for standing up and rejecting that. It's rather like the DEI movement is fundamentally a means to racism. And we all reject racism. But DEI is a way to get there. And transgender is a way to get to homophobia. And the reason we didn't have transgenderism back in the day was that it's an extremely rare condition. I mean, it's on the order of a fraction of one in a million. But now it encompasses this whole other group, which are fundamentally self-loathing people with psychiatric disease. And there you see it. There you see the globalist Marxist attack on language.
So what do we do with this? Because the conversation we're having here, you know, I would like to see it duplicated in outside of our echo chambers. And how do we break through on that? Because I think it's really important for people not to put it into a Democrat versus Republican, not to put it into Trump versus Biden-Harris so much. I think we need bigger conversations, because in order to stop this assault on American values, we need to really go upstream to the campaign financing, because I don't believe that we would be in the space we're here today. I mean, I'm pretty ashamed to as an American, I'm not even talking as a journalist now, as an American, that we're going to spend several billion dollars in an economy like this to make political operatives rich, because it doesn't cost whatever the figure is at the end of the day, and we're not going to know probably till January how many billions of dollars were being spent on this campaign. And I just think it's shameful. How do we attack this sort of corporate lobbyist grip that's on America?
I don't want to dominate the webcast, but I think you hit it. You know, there are people who say go to the streets, and that obviously is a bad idea. I mean, even though we have all the guns, we shouldn't do that. That is playing right into the game. There are people who say we should attack it with love, and I understand those people, and I think they're fundamentally culturally right. That is the humanist, you know, of all responses. But the bottom line, Christine, is what you said: follow the money, take the money out of it. The money is where it is. The money is where you break it. The money is where it's made. The money is where you break it.
How do we go up against evil? I mean, is this evil to you guys?
Yeah, I think it's deeply evil. And one of the enormous problems is that the thinking class in our culture, the highly educated people, the people with graduate degrees and the managerial class, are the ones which unfortunately have been most easily captured by what Elon Musk calls a mind virus. And they're not really susceptible to rational argumentation. So I think that this battle has to be conducted in a different way. It's probably one of the reasons that Mr. Trump is as successful as he is, although it really bothers me that in critical moments, he can be unbelievably inarticulate. Like the last debate, you know, he was speaking in fragmentary sentences and his mind seemed to be wandering, you know, glancing and ricocheting off from one subject to another. And somehow people, you know, decided he won the debate. Actually, what won the debate for him was simply the failure of Joe Biden to perform at all. I think something similar may happen in this debate, although if Mr. Trump has been properly and adequately prepared, they will have prepared him to be polite and to stay on issue. And that alone might help him. But I'm fairly confident that despite probably what is massive preparation for Kamala Harris, that she's probably not going to be able to perform. My sense of her is that she really has a kind of an anxiety problem with, being in the limelight. And so I don't know how we're going to conduct this battle. Mr. Trump is, I think, leading the battle for certain reasons, and they don't have much to do with, you know, the intellect.
So my next question is, what are you guys, as you bridged into that, Jim, what do you guys think that is going to happen here? Because I you know, as a woman, I can see where Donald Trump, for those people that want to paint him as a misogynist, okay, or a sexist, they're going to look for any window to say that his response is going to be sexist, all right? And quite frankly, if a girl's on at the platform, if she can't take the hits, she shouldn't be running as president. Okay, that's just my personal opinion. If you're going to rise to that level, you've got to put on your thick skin. So I don't believe in this sexism nonsense. At the same time, I can understand Trump is going to have to, you know, for some of these people looking for that, he's going to have to walk that fine line. But I also think that maybe Kamala Harris is looking for the zingers, because when she did do the debate, you know, and she basically turned to Biden at that time, said, "I don't believe you're a racist." That was the setup for the punchline. So I think that she's going to pull something like that. But will it work? Because remember when she did the debate with Pence, I'm talking.
I'm speaking.
That's exactly what she said. But she can't do that now, because on Tuesday night, the mics are going to be turned off. So I'm just wondering, you know, I think it's really good for Trump to have somebody like Tulsi Gabbard there, because I think Tulsi is very smart, very articulate, very measured, and can think on her feet. And she's debated, and she actually gave a punch to Kamala Harris during one of the debates before. But I don't think that Kamala Harris is a likable personality. So I think she has that going into the debate. She's just not likable, and I certainly wouldn't call her a giant intellect. And I don't know how, we haven't mentioned the word border, the human trafficking operation. I think it's very important that be raised, because it's not just at the southern border now. We're seeing the remnants of it in Chicago, New York, the rural areas and other states. Denver, exactly. Okay, we're seeing the crime go up. I mean, you can't ignore the crime. People want to say, well, the crime's not there. No, it is there in Chicago. It is there in Denver. It is there in Manhattan. We see it in the rural areas in Wisconsin and Maryland and places like that. So how do we continue to have a conversation about reality? Because I think what we're being told is, don't believe anybody who challenges something. And quite frankly, if these people that don't want to be challenged, we will lose the opportunity to hold them accountable. And that's my biggest fear about when people talk about, as Jim, as you said, you know, First Amendment. If I can't challenge somebody, then that's going to put every investigative journalist like myself out of business. And I'm willing to fight for that, because I'm willing to fight for, as you said, Jeff, protecting the children. Or as you said, Dr. Chris, about, you know, the fraud that's involved forcing shots on people worldwide that harms their bodies. I mean, I've never seen, and I never thought that I'd ever see this in my life, the institutional commodification of targeting human beings as if they're pieces of meat to be experimented on, whether it's the transgender, whether it's the medical, whether it's just, oh, we're just going to use your money to send it over to Ukraine for whatever bloody reason these guys decided, because they want to take down Putin. But, you know, everybody's being gaslit financially, medically, sexually, parental rights are being nuked. And I think it's important of how we get back to what we knew, okay, when we were kids. We knew that there was a system that was going to protect us. We knew mommy and daddy were there. We knew walking out the front door, the cops were going to be there. We knew that if Johnny did something on a Friday night, sure, officer so-and-so would knock on the door at 11 p.m. with little Johnny telling Papa, Joe, I go to church with you. Take care of your kid. You know, I mean, it was a more civilized world that we grew up in. But now we're getting to the point where people we have to vote for think it's okay to take away that which was part of our culture. How do we deal with this?
Remember one thing. What's really motivating the Democratic Party is the fear that a lot of them are going to end up being prosecuted for their crimes. And most of these crimes have, in one way or another, to do with lying to the American people. And so the evil that we're identifying is basically the untruth that has been laid on the American public like a bad trip.
Yeah, it's really true that it's the projection phenomenon. They're basically saying, hey, we did this to you. We fully expect you to do this to us. But Christine, I'd turn it back on you. You're the investigative reporter with the expertise in human trafficking, child trafficking. How would you, as an interviewer, craft a question for Vice President Harris?
I would. She said a quote the other day when she was interviewed by Dana Bash at CNN. She said, when she was asked about the flip-flop on her issues, she said her values haven't changed. So I would ask her point blank, because I believe I'm one of these people, you know, I don't think like a prosecutor, but I understand impeaching somebody, and you take their own words and you flip it around. So I would be asking Kamala Harris, what exactly are your values? And just sit back and listen to what she says. Okay, because I don't think she can articulate.
Wrong? What went so wrong with the expression of your values?
Mm-hmm. I think it's important for people to ask the question, what are your values? It's not just the policy questions. You know, although I think that the policy questions are important to a certain extent, but I think that you have to get to the motivation of what makes somebody tick. When obviously, you know, when she gets into this mode, I want to think to myself, oh my God, that's so embarrassing as a woman. I mean, who are you trying to be? But I want to find out why she thinks it's so valuable for the first time in the history of American politics at a presidential level that she should embrace being handed the coronation without the vote of the people. Because what's the difference between her and King George? That to me, that's stunning. I am surprised that people in the Democratic Party and that Americans did not have a larger voice in saying, oh no, this is not the way we play the game. And for whatever reason, the Democratic leadership or the Bidens did a, you know, screw you to people who wanted to have an open convention. They went along with that. And people, and I think the thing that's missing here is the significance of having that happen without voices coming forward and say, no, that's unacceptable. They just went along with it. Again, like everybody went along with lining up and shutting down businesses and going home and doing the six feet of, you know, distance in 2020 and 2021, lining up like sheep to take gene therapy shots that did not stop the transmission and did not prevent the disease. So we have, I think, a larger conversation that we need in America about what happened in America. The same way that, Chris, you know this, in Europe, people are saying, and Jim, Jeff, you know this too, in terms of the shots, they're not saying go ahead and get the shots. They're limiting the shots to people who are at risk and 65 years of age and older. They're not pushing it on kids. When it comes to the transgender, Cass's report in England basically brought the House of Cards down on Tavistock and said, no, we're permanently eliminating these operations and these puberty blockers for children. We know here in the United States, as of July 2022, I think it is, according to Jamie Reed's affidavit in Missouri, that the FDA has a black box warning on puberty blockers that can, the risk is for blindness. So if the FDA knows that and the parents go along with a kid going down to Planned Parenthood or the school pushing puberty blockers without the parental's consent, if your child can end up being blind and nobody can be responsible for that, it seems, I mean, I feel like we're living in an insane moment.
Hey, you know, let me just say one thing about this, that one of the remarkable things that happened in this campaign was Bobby Kennedy getting up and shifting his position and throwing his support behind Trump. But in the process of doing that, you know, he offered the American people about a 10 or 15 minute explanation of why he was doing that. That was simply the clearest political statement that's been made in this country for probably 10 years. And what was especially strange about it was apprehending how unusual that was, which should tell us that the political conversation in our time is just about completely insane.
Yes.
So it's really a question of how is the United States going to be brought back from the brink of insanity and insane behavior? And, I think it will require some kind of an intervention, whether it's by, an act of God or fate or the zeitgeist or some power that exists over us as individuals, even as a collective.
I think it's going to take something extraordinary. I don't know what it's going to be, but I think that there has to be some. And I hope it doesn't have to be a catastrophic.
I mean, one thing that has occurred to me is that there is a possibility, and I can't say, what percentage, that Kamala Harris may perform so badly in this debate that they'll have to fly in Hillary Clinton on her leathery wings to be the candidate.
Just saying. You know, you live in New York, and I hope you're dead wrong about that.
Or Michelle.
Oh, I don't.
Michelle is has a better.
No, that'll never happen.
Well, Trump is going to have to exercise some self-restraint and self-control. If he can do that, he should be able to present well on Tuesday night. And I'm thinking particularly of how he handled Rocket Man. Whatever the wisdom of parading around the world, having these photo op meetings with him and on the DMZ or whatnot, Rocket Man is a crazed, genocidal lunatic. And Trump stayed poised, professional, focused, because he needed to. And he can, if the stakes are as high as we believe they are in this election, then Trump owes it to the rest of us to behave towards Kamala Harris the way he behaved towards Rocket Man. He can do it.
Good point.
So how do you, okay, so Chris, you're a doctor. You try to get your patients to change their behavior to survive. Give us your thoughts, because we're running out of time here, on what your suggestions would be about behavioral modification.
Well, you know, what I think you're seeing with Trump is an extraordinary maturation, because there's a certain amount of adolescence that goes throughout Trump's history. And yet the difference between the guy who gave that Billy Bunch or Billy whatever, you know, comment coming off the bus years ago, that was a very adolescent sort of locker room kind of comment. And as guys, we're all kind of used to that. You know, we've all probably been there. There's certain parts of my adolescence that didn't fade away until perhaps my 60s. I think what you're seeing with Trump is a maturation that's happening. He's got an extraordinary instinct about people, and he certainly knows when there's a vulnerability and how to go for the throat. But he also has evolved in the last 10 years. And I've sort of been watching him carefully since my early days in Palm Beach, back into the 70s. This man has really matured a huge amount lately. And if he simply goes with that maturation, that adult in the room kind of thing, I really don't think it's a contest, because from an intellect standpoint, from an academic credential standpoint, he smokes her. From the experience on the world stage, he smokes her. From the fact of being right about all these things he's said, whether it's about the border or about international things, about Putin, about the Ukraine, about anything, he's been right almost every time. If he simply shows, as Jeff said, the restraint that's necessary to project an adult, then I think it's all over with. The question is, as with so many of us, would he devolve back? I mean, we see this with our kids who are 10, 12 years, our grandkids, 10, 12 years old. They can suddenly devolve back to 5, 6 years old very, very quickly. As long as he doesn't do that, as it doesn't devolve to the Trump of 15 or 20 years ago, I think it's all over with the shouting. And that's going to scare an awful lot of entrenched people who are doubling down on their basically greed, that they took the money for a lot of years and their livelihood is at stake. They have do nothing jobs and they just have been cashing the check for a long time. Those people are at serious risk if in fact he gets into the White House. And many of us, particularly those comfortably retired, are hoping he does.
All right. Anybody else? Because we got to sign off to our audience. Last words, Jim?
I can't wait to watch this battle.
Yeah. Okay. So let's circle back with you guys, and let's set up a show for later on this week after we watch the debates and see, and, you know, give our thoughts away to, you know, what went wrong or what went right, yeah, if anything does. But anyways, guys, thank you very much for joining us. I want to thank our audience as well for joining us, and we'll see you soon.
Namaste.
Thanks, Christine.
Bye. Thank you.